Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian, who's on vacation. Earlier this year, Connecticut became the 17th state to abolish the death penalty. But even as the popularity and prevalence of death sentences declines, life sentences without the possibility of parole are way up, even at a time when violent crime rates have been on a steady decline. Harvard Law Professor Charles Ogletree has been looking at this. He's co-edited a new book that looks at the sentences of life without parole and says they might not actually be that different from sentencing someone to death. He looks at the ethical and policy implications of these sentences in a new book called Life Without Parole, America's Next Death Penalty. Professor Ogletree, thanks for coming to WNYC.
Always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. Let's first look at the scope of this. 41,000 prisoners are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole. In your book, it says in 16 years, between 1992 and 2008, the number of prisoners serving those sentences has increased 230%. What's going on here?
Well, two things. One is that America is unique in being more punitive than any other country in the world, and that has something to do with local officials trying to find a way to be more punitive. The second, we have a conflict right among our midst. I consider myself an abolitionist against the death penalty, and yet many advocates against the death penalty believe in life without the possibility of parole. It's what we now call DIP, death in prison. And we've always said, as the court has said, that death is different. But so many people are dying in jail now with the LWOP sentences that we think we have to examine that as well. And my co-author, Austin Sarrett at Amherst College, and I put together a group of folks who were from all different fields to talk about this with no predetermined view about it. And not all of them are abolitionists. In fact, some of them are former prosecutors and feel pretty strong about crime and punishment. But I think we put together a pretty comprehensive book on the fact that more people are in jail, more people are dying in jail, in LWOP, which seemed like a reasonable remedy decades ago, now has made us the nation that incarcerates more people and kills more people without question.
And so when you say LWOP, that's life without parole. So I want to get clear on definitions here. Is this
right?
Are these prisoners who are sentenced, you are going to be in prison for the rest of your life, no possibility of parole? Or do these numbers also include prisoners who have the possibility of parole, but because of parole boards being reluctant to grant parole, they're effectively in prison for life?
It's more the former than the latter, because a lot of judges and jurors think, aha, we didn't take his life or her life today with the death penalty. They're just sentenced, and they'll stay in prison, and they'll be punished by that. But the reality is that the option of life without parole, like in New Jersey and other places, has become the new death penalty, and that's what we say in the book. And even though jurors think it's more humane, in fact, it's the same lack of humanity, because people die. And it's not the parole board. And what the book doesn't have, because we published it, we finished editing it more than a year ago, here in my home state of Massachusetts, over my and other folks' objections, we just passed a three strikes law. And it means that people are going to spend more time in prison than they've ever done before, and we'll see people who are dying. There's another part of this that we only mention in passing, but my good friend Brian Stevenson won these LWOP for juvenile cases in the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that you can't sentence a juvenile to life without parole, and now the Supreme Court said it. Mm-hmm. But if you sentence a juvenile to 150 years, you've done the same thing.
Well,
they're going to die in prison.
That is Miller versus Alabama. The Supreme Court made that ruling in June. And I was just in Iowa on a swing state road trip, and this was on the front of all of the newspapers. So that Supreme Court ruling said that you can't have mandatory life sentences without parole for crimes committed by juveniles.
Right.
And so what you had in Iowa was Governor Terry Branstad had there were 38 individuals who fell into this category. And this is the way he chose to deal with it. He commuted their sentences so they no longer had life without the possibility of parole, but they had 60-year prison terms. Here's how he described it.
They will not have the possibility of parole until they have served 60 years. Justice is a balance. and these commutations ensure that justice is balanced with the punishment for those who have committed these vicious crimes and also protecting the public safety of Iowa citizens. First-degree murder is an intentional and premeditated crime, and those who are found guilty are dangerous and should be kept off our streets and out of our communities.
That tapes thanks to Iowa Public Radio, but there's a couple of things in there that I want to talk with you about. The first is, what is the difference between life without the possibility of parole and a 60-year prison term if you committed a crime when you're, you know, 16, 17? You're going to be in your late 70s by the time you're eligible for parole. Does that fall in the same category as what you were looking at in this book?
What's the difference? There is none. A 17-year-old who will be 76 before they're eligible for parole is likely to die in prison, and that we can see now. And how do we know, that 30 or 40 years from now that juvenile might have been rehabilitated, might be treated differently? And no, what the judge is saying, in fact, is that, well, he committed a murder, and we can't, because the Supreme Court sentenced him to death, but we're going to make sure he's in jail until he dies. He didn't say that explicitly, but he said that implicitly, that we're going to punish him as if we're punishing an adult for committing a homicide that could be the death penalty. And that's what it is, and I think that's why this book is timely and important. And even with people who disagree with it, you have to at least see that maybe there's something true about this, as you see the number of states, and you cited in the beginning, the number of individual cases that are in the thousands now, people who are serving time in prison and who more than likely will die in prison rather than be released at some point when they're 70 or 80 or even older.
That's what I think is, when I came away from your book, it really brings up, how do we define the central mission of our correction system? Is it about getting dangerous people off the streets and keeping them there, keeping them out of our communities, as Iowa Governor Terry Branstad said right there? Or is it rehabilitation in the case of crimes committed as juveniles, what the Supreme Court was looking at earlier this year? So clearly, when you're looking at life sentences without the possibility of parole, you're saying the primary mission of the correction system in this case is to keep the most dangerous criminals absolutely out of society.
Here's the problem. Dangerous now, dangerous forever. That's what it's saying, that this is a permanent view about this individual without looking at other factors. And that's why at least some of these three strikes laws, which are going to be putting people in prison for life, if not having them die there, at least they have a safety valve that the judge can look in some cases to see whether or not a person has been rehabilitated. How do we know that the 18-year-old is going to be the same when the 18-year-old was 47 or 49 or 52? And it seems to me that as a humane and just and fair society, a kid who committed a horrible crime as a juvenile might be very different after 10, 20, 30, 40 years in jail, and we shouldn't presume that there's no chance of giving that person another opportunity to, in a sense, not only help victims. My sister, the former police officer who was murdered in 1983, and I deeply am concerned about crime and violence, but I would never advocate capital punishment for her killer, and I think that's part of it. You know, and I think a lot of victims or relatives of victims have felt the same way, that we want the person punished, but death is not what we're looking for.
And you talk about rehabilitation, but there's also the issue of cost when you look at prisoners who become older and older within the prison system. As prisoners age, they get sick, they require more health care. And you point out that as prisoners age, they're less likely to recommit crimes if they're released from prison. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And I just want to mention as well that if people go to my website, charleshamiltonhouston.org, that's one word, charleshamiltonhouston.org, they'll see a report we did for Massachusetts about the three strikes. And we talk about how you can't predict what a person's going to do decades from now. We talk about the fact that many states called red states, like Georgia, have been much more humane in the way it thinks about prisoners, etc. And we talk about the cost that, as you say, is amazing when you think about spending millions of dollars. And it has this system inverted. You'd think that we'd spend more on education, and then we have to spend less on the idea of public safety. But we spend much, much more on public safety to the point that just last year, this Supreme Court, and many call it a conservative Supreme Court, said this: the state of California was wrong the way it was treating prisoners inhumane, and that the answer was they should release them, or the Supreme Court would. So if we look at the now the billions of dollars spent with private prisons and et cetera, folks think it's a solution, but it makes much more of a solution to make make sure people can be paroled, they can be restrained and restricted, but they need to become tax-paying, wage-earning citizens who can give something back to society rather than just the opposite. And the cost, it will be very hard to find a state that's spending more on education and less on public safety, because we've got the whole system inverted, and we have to change that.
But it's interesting because you talk about the way that this has become sort of a compromise area for both opponents and supporters of the death penalty, because you have to have a way when there's a prisoner who's been who is a criminal convicted of the most heinous crimes. It's difficult for a jury or for a judge to say, I'm going to sentence you to life in prison. You may be up for parole in 15 to 20 years. So what are the questions that you'd like to see juries and judges also ask when they're facing down? You want people deserve punishment who do terrible things.
And I think that punishment is important, but I think there are other factors as well, and it shouldn't simply be punishment. You have to weigh the life of the person. And as my friend Brian Stevenson said, no one is as bad as the crime they committed, and you can't look at the isolated 6 or 7 second decision to commit a horrible crime and say that person is a murderer or a rapist as if it's a permanent label, and that person can't change. A lot of people have changed and do change. And I think that the education of the jurors is very important, because I think when people see this as a safety valve like they do in New Jersey, it's like, okay, I'm not going to sentence this person to die. I'm just going to sentence them to a period of time in prison. But they still die, and they're dying every day. And I think it takes a higher moral ground. And, you know, the Supreme Court, as conservative as one might see it being, this is a court that said you can't have a death penalty when a person's mentally retarded. You can't have a death penalty when a person's under the age of 18. And I think you can't sentence someone for life without the possibility of parole when they're a juvenile for a non-capital offense, and then more recently looking at other cases. So it's an evolving court that's trying to figure out what's cruel and unusual punishment. And I'm not saying let's take the case of the Supreme Court that they're going to rule in our favor, but I'm saying it makes a big difference. And like I said, I'm a conflicted abolitionist. I represented James Ford mm-hmm. before the Supreme Court in 1990 and got his death sentence reversed. Mm-hmm. And there were lawyers working with me. And their point is that let's go to court right away and plead guilty to life imprisonment without parole in Georgia. And it seems like a solution. James Ford didn't die, but he is going to die in prison with all of his difficulties and mental health issues. That won't be a factor because he's sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And I think that's one of the major problems that we see. And my good friends who are firm believers in capital punishment, anti-capital punishment, and so am I, don't see the harm. And death is different. As we say in this book, we're not sure that death when you're old age or sick is different from death when you're executed. One is more violent and vicious and inhumane, but the result is the same. You're dead, whether you're in prison or about to be sentenced to execution.
Isn't it different, though, if the state is killing a prisoner? I mean, that's certainly different.
It's not different in the sense that it's death, right? I mean, the reality is that you have no chance to, in a sense, show that you've changed your life and can do something different. So it's different in the sense of the tools that are used by the state, but it's not different in the result. And so, as we say in this book, and it's really other authors who say that, let's reexamine LWOP, because you folks need to understand these are folks who are sociologists, who are criminal justice experts, who have a history of being prosecutors, saying we can call it different as a simple way to describe it, but the reality is that we have to reexamine LWOP because people are dying in prison and at alarming numbers, and actually more significantly, folks are being sentenced to LWOP than you see people sentenced to death. So something is happening to filling our prisons, and we've got to figure out how to address that issue. It's getting worse before it's going to get better.
LWOP, life without parole. You say in the book, life without parole may well be the new capital punishment with all of its baggage and none of its process. And by that, you mean we just aren't used to this series of appeals and challenges that we've become accustomed to with the death penalty.
And it's very interesting. That's exactly right. And as you read, the first half of the book is looking at LWOP, and the second half is looking at some of the ways in which we should look at our criminal justice punishment system. And it talks about that. Paul Robinson, a good friend, wrote a very nice essay in the book about our traditional theories of punishment, you know, looking at rehabilitation and the general deterrence and some of the other issues. And what he concluded is that LWOP doesn't fit any of these categories. None of them seems to justify LWOP. It's there without a theory that justifies it and defines it.
All right.
That's a reminder of what we have to do going forward.
We have to leave it there. Harvard Law Professor Charles Ogletree, co-editor of Life Without Parole, America's Next Death Penalty, thanks so much for joining us on WNYC.
My pleasure.
This is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Anna Sale.